From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Genetically modified plants, we were told, were supposed to accelerate growth in crop yields and reduce the use of pesticides, feeding more people more safely. A New York Times analysis out this week asserts GMOs have not delivered on those two fronts, in spite of the fact of their widespread adoption in North America and beyond. That take has sparked a fresh debate over the value of GMOs and of the analysis itself. This hour on Point, are GMOs worth it? Do we need them? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you ready for a cost-benefit analysis of genetically modified crops? Farmers, are they delivering? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from London is New York Times investigative reporter Danny Haken. He wrote the recent Page One report headlined, Doubts About the Promised Bounty of Genetically Modified Crops. Danny, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Describe the big comparison you did that led your report to the conclusion that they weren't delivering.
Right. That's right. I guess I should start by saying there's two main types of genetically modified crops. One kind inserts genetic traits to make plants inherently bug resistant. So some kinds of bugs die if they chew on the plant. Another kind of GM crop is herbicide resistant. So you can spray a field with an herbicide, and if the crop is resistant to that specific herbicide, the crop will live, and ideally the weeds will die. Now, my story looked at the effectiveness of GMOs since they came in around 96. What my story found was that GM crops can be effective. There are different kinds of GMOs that do different things. But what I also found is that broadly, they don't appear to be accelerating yield trends. When I looked at some specific crops in the U.S. and Canada and compare them to Western Europe, where they don't use GM crops. And then also at the same time, on pesticides, my findings were somewhat mixed. Insecticide use has come down, but use of weed killers, which are used in much higher volumes in the United States, those have been coming up for a number of years. And in GM crops, you see a particular problem in soybeans.
You come to some pretty big conclusions here. Your big one, you say genetic modification in the United States and Canada, where this, of course, has been very widely adopted, you write, has not accelerated increases in crop yields or led to an overall reduction in the use of chemical pesticides. Now, to come to that conclusion, I guess you step way back, sort of 100,000 feet, and look down on the North American example in these 20 years and the European example where GMO crops have not been used, and you're looking at the big numbers that come out of that. Describe what you found.
Sure. Well, on the yields, the crop yields, I did a comparison of three crops, like I said, in U.S. and Canada, and I looked at the relative yield trends in Western Europe.
Premised on the U.S. and Canada, basically meaning very widespread adoption of GMO. Yeah. That's a presumption.
Yeah, we're seeing, 90%+ adoption of some of these crops.
Mm-hmm.
I should point out on yield, I'm not the first person to raise questions on the yield issue. Earlier this year, there was a big National Academy of Sciences report. The industry actually urged me to read that report because it dismissed the food safety issue, but it also said there was little evidence that the introduction of genetically modified crops in the U.S. had led to yield gains beyond those seen in conventional crops.
Though you remind us, that was one of the fundamental promises of the GMO revolution.
That's right, and it really continues to be. I think the most common thing I hear from executives in this industry is that, this is a technology that's really important to feeding the world, the world's growing population. And again, this story says that these crops can be effective. I think the question that I'm raising is, when you have a market penetration of 90%+, is that a smart thing to do? Should we be using them more situationally? Obviously any industry has a product to sell and they want to, they make money by selling as much as they can. But
I think your story is being read in a broader way here. The suggestion of your story to my read, and I read it closely, was that, look, Western Europe did not adopt genetically modified crops, and it's doing just fine. The suggestion of your story is that the growth in their crop yields has been as good as that in North America, and that That's their right. use of pesticides has been no worse and maybe better.
Right. I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I think, you know, in terms of the yields, there's really no discernible yield advantage that I could see. You know, no broad yield advantage between, you know, in the crops I looked at. Now, again, I think if you're talking about, you know, if you're talking about a specific circumstance where you have a specific problem, then maybe, a GM crop can be the right answer. I'm not saying that all GM crops don't work. But yes, broadly speaking, you know, that's right. I think there's, you know, I don't see the broad yield advantage, between the U.S., Canada, and Western Europe.
You, of course, know the sensitivities of the debate into which this story falls. You've got a lot of people who are very concerned.
Is it a sensitive debate? Yeah, I've noticed that.
Yeah, you may have, especially in those last few days. You may well have. I mean, but this is picked up right away by people who are opposed to genetically modified crops, saying, we don't want this. We don't. And you know, yeah. Danny Hakim has just showed us we don't need this.
Right.
Is that your intent?
Again, I mean, I think with any, GMO, anytime you wade into GMO, the GMO issue, you're going to get a very polarized reaction. I mean, I think I said the other day, people are, either see me as a genius or a dope. I think that's par for the course. Look, there's an industry here that has an entire business model built on, having sort of 90% penetration of these crops in certain markets, the U.S. and other parts of the world. So it makes a big difference to them to keep this. To keep this going. And, also they do, the industry does fund a lot of universities, a lot of ag departments. So, that does influence the debate as well.
Of course, it's kind of a package deal. Once you start using the GMO crops, then you need a lot of the other inputs, chemical inputs, pesticides, insecticide, herbicide, to work with those. And I think people could read your piece and say, well, look, there's no real advantage. It's just an industry has tied up agriculture. They can't get out of it now. They're prisoners of this system, this chain of products and genetic modification and inputs. And it's more a business strategy than a feed the world, save the planet strategy.
Well, again, I would say that there are instances where these things can be useful. And I said in the story they can be effective. So,
well, you're retreating to those two or three lines every time I ask you a question, Danny. You can see the overall impression gained here is something rather different.
Oh, well, no, I'm definitely saying that the broad yield advantage doesn't exist. And the fact is that herbicide usage is going up. I mean, weed killers, specifically herbicides, not pesticides as a whole, but weed killers.
In the U.S., where we're using a lot of these GMOs.
That's right. That's right. It's just you were making maybe a broader, a bit broader of an assertion. I do have an expert in the story that I quote, someone that the industry likes to cite a lot, who's put out some studies that show yield advantages. But again, what he told me is that a lot of his data is impacted by use of insecticide resistant crops in the emerging market, in the developing world. So, I just point to stuff like that. There can be situations where these things can be, can be helpful. I just don't want to discount that.
You look at pesticide use falling in France to make the comparative point there. But, of course, critics of the report say, well, France had sky-high pesticide use before. So, of course, it's come down there. But that doesn't really prove the point that pesticide use across Europe varies a lot. Trends in a lot of EU countries are increasing.
Sure, and I've seen some of the alternative presentations of the data, but even in the one that's most cited, over the last 20 years, this GMO period, herbicide use has been coming down in France while it's been coming up in the U.S. and even at the end there, the lines appear to be crossing. So, again, the promise of these crops was not that they would reduce use of these chemicals relative to France or anywhere else, just that they'd reduce their use, and that doesn't seem to be happening. I thought it would be interesting just to look at, you know, what the trends were like in a big non-GMO country. That was my only point, including France.
What do you think an informed and fair reader would take away from your report, Denny?
Well, again, to me, what I take away from it is we've made a decision in this market and in some other markets to have, to turn over almost our entire corn and soybean and cotton crops to genetically modified varieties. In Europe, they're not using any. They have, you know, one kind of corn they grow in small amounts. But I think the question is, you know, is that a wise choice? I guess that's the question I'm left with. Is that a wise choice, or could we be using this technology differently?
And, of course, the rest of the world is now making its own decisions about whether or not to go the GMO path. Europe has said no. North America said yes. There's right. A lot more turf to be covered here.
That's right.
Are you saying, you know, big conclusion, you don't need to go Europe's way and you can do it without?
No, again, the story doesn't say reject GM crops. Look, there are other, again, as the story says, there's other kinds of GM crops. Some, you know, can address sort of crop diseases. You know, others can sort of add nutrition. I think with each crop, with each kind of trait that you're adding, you just have to, you know, you have to look at it and see if it's really adding value.
Denny Hakim, investigative reporter with the New York Times, joining us today from London. His big piece over the weekend, kind of a bombshell, not all new, but forcefully put, that the advantages may not be what were promised on the GMO front. Denny, thank you very much for joining us this hour.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about GMO crops, genetically modified, and whether they are delivering on their promise of extra great yields to feed the world and less use of chemical pesticides in farming. A big new New York Times story says they are not. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Did you read it? Did it leave you wondering if it's not working? Why are we doing it? Why are we using GMOs? And farmers, how does all this look to you? Are you glad to have the genetically modified seeds, the freedom to pour on the Roundup, herbicide to kill weeds? Do you feel like you're optimizing with GMOs? Or do you feel strapped into a system where you've got to buy the GMO lines and got to buy the chemicals to make them work? Mike Frank is a senior VP, chief commercial officer of Monsanto. Here he was at a Wall Street Journal Global Food Forum in New York in October, saying the use of GMOs all over the world is growing. Here he is.
We've been highly innovative and successful in taking technologies to farmers around the world. You talked about GMOs, and so today GMOs are grown in 28 countries mm-hmm. by about 19 million farmers on about 440 million acres. So this is a technology that in the last 20 years has been very successful.
It has certainly expanded very widely and certainly has avid supporters. On the other hand, there's been a constant drumbeat of skepticism out there. Here's Michael Pollan, author of Food Rules. He said that Monsanto puts out ads saying there are 10 billion people coming and a fixed amount of arable land, and we need genetically engineered, or GE crops, he's calling them here, to increase crop yields. This was a couple of years back, but here's Michael Pollan.
That sounds good, but look at the history. The history of GE, they've been at it for 20 years. They have not increased yield. That's not what they do. Ask a farmer, and they will say, no, it's not about increased yield. What it's about is I can handle more land because I don't have to do the three sprayings of herbicide. I can handle more land because if there's an outbreak of European corn borer over there, I'm covered. I don't even have to pay attention to it because the plant will put out the pesticide. A lot of GE is being sold to us based on a future promise that I don't even think they're working on. We are being sold a pig in a poke.
We're being sold a pig in a poke, says Michael Pollan. The big piece over the weekend has got a lot of people talking. We want to dive in and see what we can sort out here. Fred Gould joins us right now from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, professor of agriculture at North Carolina State University. He is chair of the committee that Denny Hakim was talking about there that put out a report earlier this year at the National Academy of Sciences. Came out in May, Genetically Engineered Crops, Experiences and Prospects. which had some pretty grabbing conclusions. Fred Gould, thank you very much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you, Tom.
And with us from Riverton, Wyoming, is Andrew Kniss, Associate Professor, Department of Plant Sciences at the University of Wyoming. He has written in response to Denny Hakim's piece over the weekend and thought a lot about these issues. Andrew Kniss in Wyoming, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Fred, first to you on the subject of yield. Danny says the promise was greater, faster growth in yields with GMOs. Now we've got a lot of experience. They're on millions and millions of acres. Is that part, has that panned out? Has that proved true, Fred?
Yeah, so I think it's worth going back to our report in which we looked at the rate at which yields were going up in the U.S. in cotton, corn, and soybean since the 1980s. And indeed, the yields are going up in the U.S. over that time in those crops. The question was whether in 1996, when we started to use genetically engineered crops, did we see that rate of increase go faster? And from our analysis, mostly from USDA data, we didn't see any evidence that there was an increase in the rate that yield was increasing. And separate from the report, I mean, if we looked at yields in wheat, they were also going up, but wheat in the U.S. and Canada is not genetically engineered. The issue was the fact that they were going up at the same rate. If we didn't have genetic engineering, would they have leveled off because of global climate change? And the comparison with wheat shows that even if things weren't engineered, they'd be going up. So Danny's stuff on the European comparison does fit into similar results that we had. But I just want to say that's yield is just a piece of this. There are other things that are going on with all that, and we can get to the decrease in pesticide use when you're ready.
Well, I guess people look at that. We'll go there, but people look at the yield part and say, well, we expected there might be some risks with GMOs, but we went forward because we have a growing global population. We figured we'd need the extra food and the extra growth in harvests, extra fast growth in harvests. Right. Is the suggestion here for a layman listening to this that GMOs don't deliver that, therefore, why take the risk? I mean, it's kind of late now. They're all over the place. But why take the risk if you can get the same growth and yield without genetic modification?
Right. As you heard from Pollan and others, there are other things that are happening because of GE crops, and not just in the U.S., but in other countries. So I've been in China and watched some of the situation there where they have almost 100% genetically engineered cotton that produces this BT toxin that kills insects. Mm-hmm. And there's been a real reduction in insecticide use, and there it's really important because people go out with backpack sprayers and they have pesticide running down their backs because of leaks.
Yeah.
They wind up in the hospital. So when we talk about the U.S., that's one thing. When we talk about developing countries, you could see a different picture where there's pretty good evidence that there's been a decrease in hospitalizations.
Andrew Kniss, in Wyoming, we'll look at pesticides in a minute. Can we just look at yield and growth in yield for a second? I mean, in fairness, you say that this conversation is tiresome. You're over it and past it. And I wish you'd share why that's the case for people who don't follow it as closely as you. And then what about the yield question? You may be over it, but explain why it doesn't look important to you, perhaps.
Well, it's not that it's not important, because, I mean, ask any farmer and yield is among the most important things they consider. You know, and they've adopted this technology. And I think what gets lost in this conversation about do GMOs increase yield is that there are really two aspects of yield. When you look at what a farmer is actually able to produce, there's two things that go into it. There's yield potential, and that's kind of what a farmer could potentially grow on that field if everything goes right.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, not everything goes right every year for a farmer. In fact, almost never does that happen. So the other side of the yield equation is yield protection. So how much of that yield can we actually protect from things like freezing and drought and floods and temperatures and pests? And that's, I think, the key thing in this conversation is, you know, the contribution of our current pest management traits that are our GMO is not on the yield potential side. And I don't think anyone thought that we, you know, the GMOs that we currently have on the market would increase yield on that side of the equation. But they are, I mean, there's lots of data out there to show that they do protect that yield potential when pests are present. And I think that's a really key thing to understand because, you know, the best estimates of crop losses due to weeds and insects and pathogens, you know, every year world crop loss is anywhere from 25% to 40% due to these pest organisms.
But is that a backpedaling? I mean, you're saying it's downside protection in case you've got a bad year. But the promise seemed to suggest something, an upside promise here, that overall yield would grow faster because of GMOs. Did it not, Andrew?
Well, you know, I don't know the original claims. I'm fairly new to this one. I was graduating high school when this technology came out. So I don't know what was promised, you know, 20 years ago. But I do know that, you know, when farmers look at yield, you know, pests are not an issue that they only have to deal with sometimes. And so these are always prophylactic treatments. I mean, weeds are robbing yield in every field around the world every year. You know, pests and insect pests and diseases are probably a little bit more sporadic, but still it's regular enough occurrence that it's not necessarily just an insurance policy. I mean, it's a way to reduce the risk and make sure that as much of that yield potential exists in that genetics of the seed and in the soil and the field is protected so that they don't lose as much of that yield.
Fred Gould, is it clear that the United States is doing better on that front than Europe, which does not use GMOs?
Well, Andrew brings up a good point about the protection of yield, and that's not the comparison that Andrew was doing or that the National Academy was doing. But you should see, if you're protecting the bottom part of it, you should see the mean going up, and, mm-hmm. and that's not what we're seeing. But I think Andrew has a good point that these crops are being protected. But I think one of the reasons why you may not see the yield increase is that before you had the BT crops that are protecting against these caterpillars and beetles, you were using insecticide to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. So you're substituting one way of getting rid of those pests with another. In terms of the BT, so if if there's no reason to expect a yield increase if you were killing the pests with insecticide versus killing them with the BT. But the BT is very specific. It doesn't kill natural enemies. And when people look at the diversity of insects in a field, it's much higher when the BT is being used than when an insecticide is being used. And the same thing with herbicides, that before you had Roundup ready or glyphosate ready crops, you were using herbicides, but different ones. And the question becomes not really the pounds of herbicide per acre or hectare. It's really how toxic these are to the environment and to humans. And there may be some argument about it, but in general, the glyphosate is less problematic environmentally than some of the other herbicides that had been used. So again, that doesn't increase yield, but it changes the footprint.
Well, let's look at that. I mean, Danny Hakim's piece makes a lot of this on this side as well. Pesticides, which is used there to include both insecticide and herbicide, I guess.
Right.
He says that the use has not fallen any faster in the U.S. with all of its GMOs, and Canada with all the GMOs, than it has in Europe. Now, people are concerned about toxicity, so you'd like to see those levels going down. What about that gross comparison? We've got a lot of genetically engineered crops, but we don't see any more decline in pesticides than they've had. Is that fair? What does it tell you?
Well, I guess what I'm saying is it's not the number of pounds mm-hmm. that are put out, right? So when our study and the National Academy study didn't see, you know, saw a little bit of variation in the number of pounds going down and going up a little bit, but we reported that we, again, may be tired of hearing about pounds of insecticide or pounds of herbicide because you have to take into account what the environmental and health footprint of those are. So if you're dealing with substituting an environmentally more friendly herbicide for one that's problematic, that's good. But again, if you're using too much of it, like the glyphosate, and you get weeds becoming resistant to it faster than if there was a integrated pest management system used, then that is a problem. These are, you know, more complicated mm-hmm. issues. But I would say that Danny's bringing up some very important pieces for us to look at.
Let's go to our listeners. Elliot in Nashville, Tennessee. You're on with Fred Gould and Andrew Kniss.
Hello, thank you.
Yeah.
Hey, I'd like to talk about the long-term use, because I'm a plant scientist from out of college here, and I've heard that GMOs over a long term, you know, if you have a field of crops, you know, let's say corn, and you have a college that is trying to whittle down the corn smut disease that attacks corn each year, and say we have like a 9% decrease on corn smut.
Okay.
And they have the corn that goes out to the field to be tested, you know, they mass produce it and they send it after being grown from a single area and tested from a single area. And it's sent out oftentimes across the United States and it's grown in different places.
You're talking GMO and corn. Okay. Yep.
Exactly. And I've heard from other scientists who have worries that basically the increase in GMO is going to eventually decrease our biodiversity in our crop supplies, and therefore open us up to pests as the climate changes and, you know, heat increases in certain areas and cold increases in others. And I just wanted to see what they had to say about the biodiversity over long term of GMO use.
Of our crop supply and this range of seeds and crops themselves. Andrew Kness, what do you say to this?
You know, I actually think Fred might be the better one to look at that. I do think the NAS report did look at genetic diversity and whether that has decreased in some of the crops. So he might actually be a little bit better.
Fred, what do you say then?
Yeah, well, when we looked at that, we looked over time, not just since 1996, and we did see earlier on a decrease in genetic diversity. And this has led to problems with corn and the pathogens that attack it in the past. The southern corn leaf blight was a major thing that woke people up to the problem of decreased diversity. But since 1996, we haven't seen any further decrease in genetic diversity. But I would say that these issues about pests adapting and maintaining this diversity is critical. And we do have to be concerned in some ways about what's going to happen with consolidation of the industry.
Which is going on right now, and Elliot sees that, of these crops being, you know, mass-produced and shipped all over the place.
Yeah.
And, yes, of course, you have consolidation, Monsanto and Bayer and Syngenta going into a Chinese fold.
Right. But I would say that, indeed, they don't just test these things in one place. There's multiple-year testing in a variety of locations to make sure that the resistance to the pathogen in one area also works in another area. So there is quite a bit of testing before the release. But the same thing comes with the herbicide tolerance. You know, if you overuse any chemical, you're going to select for the insects or the pathogens or the weeds adapting to that, and then you're going to have your crisis. And just to say, you know, the BT cotton has worked great in China and India, but now the insects in India are becoming resistant to those BT plants, and that leads to more problems down the line. So we have to think about the sustainable use of these technologies.
Andrew Kness, just a half minute before the break here, but you know, Europe has said no, North America has said yes. What about the rest of the world? Is it going to be China's got a lot of yes going on to GMOs? Do you think GMOs will be the planetary norm, or might the European model still be the one that becomes more widespread?
You know, I think over time, GMOs are going to be all over. I think, you know, farmers everywhere, as a rule, want this technology. You know, there are obviously some exceptions, but the saturation of these traits in the markets where they've been allowed is amazing. I mean, it's adopted as fast or faster than really any technology we've ever seen in cropland agriculture. So yeah, I think eventually, if regulators allow these traits to be sold, farmers will buy them.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Wonder Capital, asking what if you could help combat global climate change and make money at the same time? Introducing Wonder Capital, the award-winning investment platform that allows individuals to invest in solar energy projects across the U.S. Wonder's online investment platform allows you to earn up to 8.5% annually while diversifying your portfolio, curbing pollution, and combating climate change. And best of all, Wonder Capital doesn't take any fees for investing your money. Create an account for free at wondercapital.com/onpoint. Wonder Capital. Do well and do good.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about GMO crops, genetically modified, and whether they're delivering on their promise of extra great yields to feed the world and less use of chemical pesticides in farming. A big New York Times piece suggested, hey, Europe's done just as well without going the GMO route that North America's gone. And it's got a lot of people talking about its implications. Andrew Kness is with us from the University of Wyoming. He's pushed back on the Times piece over the weekend, said, hey, look at the local areas in particular regions where the GMO crops are important. Look at the protection of downside failure here in crops. Fred Gould is with us from North Carolina State University. He's chair of a committee for the National Academy of Sciences that put out a big report earlier this year. They said GMO crops produce safe food for humans, but they also rebutted the notion that yields have had extra growth because of genetic modification. We're going to hear in a minute from Duane Grant, who works with sugar beets on large scale in Idaho. But lots of callers here. First, Alan in Nashville, Tennessee. Alan, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Tom. I just wanted to start to comment on the red flags that are raised by analyzing the kind of arguments that are made by the industry on an ongoing basis.
Okay.
And I guess I should start off by saying that, you know, I work with about 100 small farmers here in Middle Tennessee, none of whom grow GMO crops.
Okay.
And I've done a lot of research on my own. But one of the things, like just this last thing that your guest said, that he's using the idea that the technology grew so quickly as proof that it would be adopted and welcomed by the farming community. What he's leaving out, of course, is that the really flowery promises that we're seeing aren't coming true entice people to do exactly that. And, of course, the Green Revolution itself, if we had not gone down the road of chemicals killing our living soil systems, which are the main thing that protects against insects and pests, then, of course, we wouldn't have to worry so much about trying to decrease all of this pesticide use. But, you know, the simple things like the fact that they're trying to hide the existence of GMOs within the finished food product, in lack of labeling, in other words. All of these things are red flags. And then perhaps the worst one, and this will be my final thing,
okay.
Tom,
okay.
is that with GMOs, we're talking about genetic technology here. We literally are too immature as a species to say with any certainty that we know the long-term implications of meddling around in the internal things. Now, once we cross a species barrier that we can never have crossed with just selective breeding and things like that, you realize that something is really amiss. Now, if they're right, great. But what if they're not right? How are we supposed to know the long-term implications? And I bring the whole thing about junk DNA. Look at what happened with science and junk DNA. For a long time, everybody said, oh, it's junk. It's called junk because it doesn't serve a purpose. Well, the last few years, we've learned that it actually serves some very important purposes. We can't afford to make these kinds of mistakes if we're going to shift our entire agricultural system in this direction.
Hey, Alan, what do you mean when you say that GMOs are leading to chemicals killing our living soil systems, quoting you there? What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, the Green Revolution, which started the chemical revolution, and then the GMO technology, which is still somewhat reliant on those same kinds of chemicals, what they do is they kill the soil bacteria. They kill all the living things that are happening in soil. They create the symbiosis between soil nutrients and the plants that need to uptake them. All of these things, this is a living system that's been developed over millennia, millions of years even, And we think that we're so arrogant that we think that we can show up that system by throwing a few synthetic chemicals. We're so proud of our ability to create something toxic and throw it all over our world and say, look how great we are. And I say that's a real problem.
Alan, I appreciate your call. Fred Gould, what about that? Of course, lots of GMO fields, they'll take they're Roundup ready. You can put a lot of pesticide, herbicide on there. And American farmers do, soybeans, let's say. Is there a cost in terms of the overall ecosystem, the living soil, as our caller says?
Right. Well, you know, I don't want to doubt that certainly agriculture in its general approach affects soils and microbiomes and biodiversity. But when we did comparisons of conventional crops, I mean today's conventional crops and how they're treated compared to the genetically engineered crops, we did not see any changes that were problematic. That doesn't mean that they couldn't be there, and we're very careful in the report to talk to that. I do want to get at that point that he also brought up about that we're messing with the genes and bringing in different species and such, and we don't know what the results are going to be. And I want to bring that up because one of the things in our report that sort of got lost in the sauce here was that what we're seeing is that we're winding up with the idea of having genetically engineered and conventionally bred crops as being separate, but they're no longer that separate. These technologies are getting interfaced, and the same breeder who's using one is using the other, and there are new technologies coming around. And what we came to as a conclusion from this is that we shouldn't be looking at crops in terms of their safety, just in terms of how they were made, what technology was used, but rather look at the actual crop itself and its content. And we are now not in 1996 anymore. We have much more sophisticated tools to look at any kind of unintended effects that happen to the crop itself, what you're going to eat. So you can look at that in terms of its DNA, in terms of its protein, in terms of its metabolomics, and that should be done for any kind of crop that's novel. Anything that's coming on board that we haven't seen before. Nobody worries at all when we make a new hybrid putting two crops together. When you think of a tangerine or anything else, those are all accepted. But you're putting two species together and not worrying. We're saying that when you do something really new, when you're producing something new, you should look at it in terms of what its composition is in detail, not just 60 components, but thousands that we could look at today.
Fred, Andrew Kness, please stand by. Dwayne Grant joins us right now, today from Phoenix, Arizona, but he's a potato and beet farmer in Rupert, Idaho, normally. He's also chairman of the Amalgamated Sugar Company. That's a cooperative of more than 750 beet farmers in the Northwest, produces about 10% of the sugar consumed in the U.S. annually. Dwayne Grant, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
I'm sure you saw the Times story over the weekend, and it's saying, look, yields haven't grown as fast as promised beyond the non-GMO front in Europe, and pesticide use is not down in the way that people hoped or anticipated, and put question marks over the whole sort of GMO front and the importance of it. How do you look at that as a big beet farmer?
Yeah, Tom, thanks, and great question. Danny started out the hour by saying he took a 100,000-foot view at agriculture and drew the conclusions that he referenced in his story and actually wrote quite provocatively about in his story. And I think it's important to understand that agriculture is local. We make choices as to what seeds, which genetics to select for our farms, at least on a field basis. And as we use technology today, we're actually looking at sub-field basis, in some cases down to selecting seeds for on a per-acre basis. So farmers look at this question locally, not globally. And when you look at it globally or from the 100,000-foot level, you really miss the detail that drives farmers to adopt this technology. I'll tell you specifically, in my case, up in the Pacific Northwest, Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, our growers have seen yield increases. We had a yield increase trend line established for the 15 years prior to the introduction of genetically modified technology to sugar beet production. Mm-hmm. After that, Tom, we saw after we began using GMO technology, we saw an 87% increase in our trend line yield. So in our case, absolutely, we saw the increase.
So I get it. Field by field, even part of the field by part of field, different crops and sugar beets have done very well with this. But overall, shouldn't all those locals do add up to one big picture? And Danny's report says, look at the biggest picture of all, and you don't see an advantage here.
Yeah, so I would just say again, Tom, that you're looking at Europe versus the U.S., and I think any scientist, any statistician would say be careful about drawing conclusions by comparing those two, because they could very well be apples and oranges. I think it's more important to look at the individuals that are making personal business choices on their own operations. Does this offer a plausible return for my investment. And the vote is over 90% of U.S. farmers, when they have the option to select seeds that have been improved by genetic technology, are opting to pay the higher price and capture the benefits that are offered by the technology.
Fred Gould, is that a real choice, or do farmers feel like they don't have much of a choice because this is kind of the American system now?
Well, it is the American system. It's the way agriculture has been going to increased farm size and increased efficiencies. And these crops, as has been pointed out, increase the efficiency. I think Michael Pollan brought out, too, that it allows you to plant more acreage and increase your farm size. So those are things that farmers, given the choice, will do. And if you don't choose to do that, your efficiency is not going to be as high and you'll probably go out of business. So it's an interesting kind of thing. As the companies always say, they farmers have a choice. They can buy non-GM seeds, but for many farmers, because of the increased efficiency, not higher yield, but increased efficiency, you can't just get by without using GM crops and have high enough income to keep your farm going.
Let's get a call from John in Kingston, Ontario, in Canada. John, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Nice to chat. Very quickly, I'm a college professor. A few years back, I decided eccentrically to do something slightly different. I got myself a tractor and drove it across Canada interviewing farmers on site and had them take me around their farms. And now I have about 400 hours of interview footage with Canadian farmers.
That's a slow trip. What did you learn on the GMO front, John?
Well, 28 kilometers an hour, so about 18 miles. It was horrible. As for GMOs, the one and only point I'll make here is the matter of time horizon. And farmers deal with time differently from the rest of us, even those already growing or those growing GMOs. But on the specific question of GMO versus non-GMO, I came across two perfect examples of farmers who had just kind of gone cold turkey. They decided they were going to do it. They were financially able to do it and so on. And in both cases, they sat me down at the kitchen tables and we went over their books for the 10-year process and so on and so forth. And the point that both of them made is, look, if you're going to judge non-GMO production efficiency, et cetera, you can't do it a year into the experiment or 2 years into the experiment. It was in about year five that we started seeing our yields back up to where they were when we were growing GM products, and our income, in fact, was even back up close or at the level when we were growing GM products.
So 5 years to get off of GMO and bring the yield back up. Do you think that's the way the world is going to go, John?
No, I don't, and that's the cognate point here. We like the cautionary principle, but I think we're terrible about brooking any respect for ambivalence. You know what? A guy out in the middle of Saskatchewan or western Kansas with 2,000 acres of canola, he's not going to start growing organic carrots, and we have to be okay with that. But we also have to be okay that, you know, an increasing number of ex-urban landscapes may crop up five-acre product yields and so on, and big ag is not, generally speaking, very receptive to that. So the two kind of ends of the spectrum need to respect one another and to say, well, we could use, you know, a healthy combination of each of these things.
John, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Watch out for that long tractor ride. Andrew, you know, this piece in the Times seemed to suggest that there's a kind of global choice here. And North America's gone one way, Europe's gone another, and the world could still decide one way or the other. Do you see it like that, Andrew?
You know, I guess I don't, I'm not a big fan of trying to carve any part of agriculture into dichotomies.
But that is a big dichotomy. They said no to GMO. We've said yes in a big way. That is a dichotomy.
Well, and I think at the country level, you know, comparing Europe to the U.S., there is a dichotomy there. But if you look at growers in the U.S., you know, there's a lot of farmers in the U.S. that are growing both GMO and non-GMO. You know, they're hitting non-GMO markets, or they're growing crops where GMO crops aren't available. So I think we like to simplify things down into black and white, but that's not how farmers usually see the world, at least not the farmers I know. You know, farmers are seeing many shades of green as they look out onto their field. You know, things aren't black and white, and so you know, the GMO, non-GMO is, you know, relevant on these kind of 100,000 foot views. But when you get down to the field, like Duane said, you know, things are a lot more complex and nuanced than just, do I buy a GMO seed or not?
Duane, do you have sugar beet farmers in, I don't know, in Germany or Europe who are outperforming you here without GMO or not?
There are sugar beet farmers in Europe who have better soils, better environments, and are producing more sugar per acre than I would personally produce on an acre, Tom. So, you know, directly to your mm-hmm. question, it's possible. But again, the relative, the valuable comparison is what do unimproved seeds produce on my farm, on my soils, in my environment, versus seeds that are improved. And there, you know, the jury has been out. It's come back in, and the improved seeds win hands down.
Fred Gould, last word goes to you. The big piece raises the question of which way things go. Is that a question to your mind, or is that a done deal? Europe may not go down the GMO road, but the rest of the world will?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't know, but I would say that probably GM crops, but more so advanced breeding approaches that are not GM will be things that will be adopted. They may not come under the name of GM because they're not bringing a new species in. But just to say, you know, the question of whether we need them to feed the world is not a good question to ask. Of course, you know, this is a very complicated issue, and you could feed the world without GM crops, or you could have GM crops and have bad distribution of the food and have problems.
Whew. All right. That's a dense weave with lots of threads in it. We'll try and pick it apart year by year as we go. Fred Gould at North Carolina State, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Andrew Kniss at the University of Wyoming, thank you so much for being with us, Andrew.
Thank you for having me.
Duane Grant with the Amalgamated Sugar Company out of Rupert, Ohio. Mr. Grant, thank you.
It's Idaho, and thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.